the environment's changed massively, and therefore your shareholder lists will have changed, because we aren't running as much money now as we did 15 or 20 years ago for segregated clients, and life insurance clients have also moved around and changed where they allocate their capital. So therefore, the money for the people for whom we're investing in your companies have changed dramatically.
Well, good afternoon and welcome everyone to Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast, recording for the first time in front of a live audience. I'm really excited to be here today. In the room, we've got leaders from listed companies in the UK, a very experienced IR audience. So I'm very much looking forward to some challenge around questions later on in the format. I'm Clara Melia. I'm the founder of Equatory. So we are Europe's largest dedicated investor relations consultancy. Yeah. I've got plenty of colleagues in the room today, both past and present. And also thank you to Pamir Liberum for hosting and their hospitality. So the theme for today is attracting capital in a changing global equity landscape. It's a broad theme, and there's going to be plenty to discuss and debate and challenge around this topic. So I'd like my panel to introduce themselves, to give some context behind their answers they'll be giving to the Q&A today, and provide some context and background on their personal areas of focus and experience. So let's start with Natalie Bell.
Hi everyone, and thank you for having me. I'm Natalie Bell. I'm a fund manager at Lion Trust as part of the Economic Advantage team. And a point of note about Lion Trust business model is that we have 7 investment teams who operate independently of each other. So you may have come across some Lion Trust teams, but we don't interact with each other on investments or share ideas. So I understand that can be confusing, but hopefully you'll understand a bit more about our team and our investment process through this morning. So this afternoon, the Economic Advantage team run 4 unit trusts in the UK, from micro cap up to large cap. And we're looking for companies with a significant advantage in intangible assets. And we define that as IP, so patents, trademarks, know-how, trade secrets, distribution, a physical form of Diageo, or a digital form of, say, Sage in accounting software, and recurring income, contracted recurring income of 70% or more. So that's what we're looking for, an enduring competitive advantage, and we want to capture a compounding potential within companies.
Thank you. And then Thomas?
Yeah, I'm Thomas Moore. I have been working in the city now since 1998, started at Schroders, had 4 or 5 years there, and then I moved over to up to Edinburgh, met Keith Skeoch, who latterly was currently CIO at the time, and then latterly became CEO. And I worked as an analyst initially, and then went back into UK equities, where I'd started at Schroders doing UK equity income. And I've been doing that ever since, and it's been about 16 years now I've been doing UK equity income. So I've met lots of companies, many of you here today. And at the moment, the way we've structured our teams at Aberdeen, it's changed a bit, because I think you've all noticed, when you've noticed some change in personnel, when you sort of contact each company, you probably noticed that there's been a shift away from regionalized products towards thematic products. And we've done that as well. So about 2022, I think it was, we just disbanded UK equities completely. We became developed market equities, which at first felt very unnatural, because I was suddenly talking about companies that, frankly, most people weren't that interested in. But actually what we then did was become very focused. And so I work very closely with somebody that Clara and Ray know, Wes McCoy, who's a value manager. And we created what was called a value pod. And we became very focused on exploiting that gap in the market. So companies which are cheaply valued and which offer great opportunity. And that fits quite nicely with income. So that's been our journey. And I work with lots of other UK managers. So not dissimilar from Natalie, actually, we all do slightly different things. There is some overlap between what we do. And so we do attend the same meetings and we have common research. But actually, we spend the bulk of our time focused on sort of areas which are peculiar to our particular mandate, which in my case is income.
Thank you. And Ray?
I'm Ray Mayle. I've been at Panmure, and now Panmure Liberum, for the last 6 years. But I started in 1989, originally as a fund manager, just under a decade. Then in 1998, joined Cazenove to start broking. At various points, I did most things at Cazenove in specialist sales and general sales, but my main focus has been on the general financial sector and also being the global tobacco analyst. odd pairing, I know, but it works. Don't question it. I've known these two as clients for a long time. And as I said, our background at Panmure is about mid-cap broking and about a specialisation on the UK in particular client base, but with a very strong US distribution team too.
Great. So we're going to start by talking macro, talking about the big picture, some of the structural shifts we're seeing in global equities today. There's been lots of negative press around the UK, sustained period of fund outflows from the UK. And actually, we're going to flip that on its head and talk about what we see that's positive. So, Thomas, perhaps you'd like to start by sharing how are the changes in the economic backdrop really benefiting UK companies, and how should our audience be thinking about how those could benefit them in the way they present their equity story?
Yeah, the key change, I think, isn't one of these events like Brexit or COVID or Ukraine. Actually, the key event has been the shift from QE to a more normal interest rate environment. And the reason I say that is actually they overlap in some cases, these events. But really, the key thing that happened was it's hard to believe now. Do you remember that period when if you were a Danish person, you could take out a mortgage and you get paid by the bank? So Jyske Bank were offering a 10-year mortgage with a negative 0.5% mortgage rate. And that was mad. Obviously, we look back and say, how was that? But the reason that's relevant to you in this room today is that the cost of capital has gone up. And with that has come improved capital discipline. So I think that a lot of the time when I'm speaking to Ray about a tobacco company, for example, or a lowly financials company, these companies have been focused throughout most of the time. There are the odd exception, and Ray was very vocal when there was an exceptional period in that. But during that period, they've focused mainly on what they're good at, so cash flows, paying out cash flows in the form of dividends. And so as an income investor, that's quite an attractive thing for me to be focused on. And lots of companies do that here today. And we've had some lovely streams of dividends. And then, sometimes these companies actually things go well. And then the share prices go up and you get a really nice total return from that combination of dividends and share price. But, you know, what was interesting during that QE period was I think it encouraged really bad behaviour. And I'm not blaming you in the room here today for that bad behaviour, but poor capital discipline, storytelling. Now, we can talk about ESG later, but ESG was actually during this period as well. So there were a lot, and it's the reason I'm not blaming any of you here today was that we were raising money in the City of London, you know, in the fund management industry for products that were being sold to clients on the basis of these wonderful stories about growth and about the 10-year view. Well, if you've got negative 0.5 rates, it pays you to buy something with cash flows in 10 years' time. Because you don't need cash flows today. If you have cash flows, say, ironically, that's actually a negative. I mean, you can't get your head around it now, can you? But with a positive discount rate, which we now have, you are all now being encouraged to do sensible things with your capital. So you're being encouraged to hoard capital where necessary to invest in sensible projects, but then also to distribute capital via dividends or buybacks and avoid zany projects that don't make any sense. And so I think the cost of capital has actually created a wonderful environment for UK corporates, because by doing that for a few years, you are now generating really good positive returns, which you can go out and preach to people like me about. And suddenly, actually, it's the makings of a really strong return for UK equities. So even though we're at this very low ebb in terms of capital markets activity.
Great. And Natalie, what do you see to be about positive in UK equities today?
Well, I think there's a great valuation opportunity that's kind of arisen from the outflow environment. And I think it's quite interesting seeing some more international interest coming into the market. And I think we're at a kind of moment in time where people are starting to think about their allocation decisions and perhaps a concentration in the US and feeling a bit more uncomfortable about that. And I think that's a great opportunity for the UK market. And I think we're starting to see that at the larger end of the scale. And we very much hope that that will broaden out into more small cap and mid cap as well. But I think increasingly we're hearing from companies as well. And we're pleased to hear that you are marketing your businesses overseas as well and spreading that story, because I think that valuation opportunity will be received more openly, where people are looking to change their allocations more broadly away from that concentration risk.
Just talking about the UK being so undervalued, do you sense, Thomas, just perhaps frustration with the management teams and the IRs that you're talking to? Do you have any advice for those sat in the room who might be frustrated with where their valuation is today?
I think it is sad. In many ways, it's sad because we are under an obligation to look after our clients. Our first duty is to our clients. Now, sometimes we have these situations where we have to make a decision. And at the moment, we're being offered not very much money, in many cases, for takeout bids. I won't name any names, but there are some very difficult decisions ahead for funders like us, because you can sense the frustration among some CEOs. They just think, look, I've produced these returns, I've shown this growth, and I'm not getting rewarded for it. So in some cases, I think you're either going to need to say, OK, we're not going to vote for this deal or that deal, and we're going to give this another try. But actually, you know, you can see the frustration is, why should it be any different to the next 5 years? So we then need to work with that management team to help work out what's the route forward to generate that re-rating. And maybe it is just a moment in time. Maybe this is the low ebb. I hope it is. I think Natalie's made a good case that it is.
Yeah, and actually talking to Wes on the podcast, there is a cyclical element. We'll see structural challenges in the UK, but then we are also at a point in the cycle. And just a quick follow-up before I bring Ray into the conversation. Does that make it hard for you to look at IPOs when you're seeing within your existing portfolio so many assets sitting on big valuation discounts?
I was just going to say, it makes any new idea difficult because you're kind of looking across your portfolio. It's cheap. They're companies you know well. There's outflows in the market. So that decision about where to allocate is different because the companies you own are themselves very, very cheap. And so that's the competition for capital as much as anything. And as Thomas has said, they're when money does come back in through, you know, takeover activity, then there's a lot of different, there is a lot heightened competition for that. And I guess I feel a lot of empathy for management teams because I think we're in the same situation, you know, managing active funds and facing outflows. Often if we are trimming around the edges, you know, it is flow driven. And so I think an important message is that we need to get over to our two management teams when we meet them is that if we are selling, it's not necessarily a lack of conviction or anything else in their story, but rather kind of managing that broader flow picture. So I think the feedback becomes very important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more how important it is to understand the reasons for selling and understand that directly in conversation as an IR professional with fund managers, as well as just relying on feedback from the brokers. So, Ray, I'll bring you into the conversation. We're seeing a lot of reforms in the UK, LSE, and obviously relaxation of the listing rules. How are you seeing the benefits of these reforms, or are you seeing the benefits of these reforms?
To be honest, I think it's quite mixed at this stage because all those lots of reforms that have been talked about, the actual practical implications of them still haven't really hit. The bigger issue comes back to the valuation point. Frankly, if a company's got a good reason to go out and raise equity, the market would be there and would be willing to support it. You saw it recently with the Chesnara rights issue. Fully subscribed share price actually rose on the day, I mean, which is rare to see that at a rights issue at the best of times. So there is support there for good companies doing right things. The problem is that where the valuation base starts, it becomes quite difficult to then make acquisitions which make financial sense, which you can then sell to the market. So we need to address that valuation part first. You know, partly that's the company's own work, share buybacks, show you how obviously cheap it is to go buying back your own shares. And the level of private equity interest buying things, coming back to that same point again, shows you there is a proper valuation case. I've been looking at these valuation arguments for 35 years, one market versus another, and they're quite dry and they're quite difficult to get anyone to be convinced about. But you've seen the evidence. You've seen so many companies taken privately, 20, 30% premium over the prevailing share price, half what they were 2 years prior, and probably half what they're actually worth. And that's definitely where I feel the frustration as well.
And have you seen, as Pamela Liberum, seen transactions become quicker and easier to execute as a result of some of the reform?
From our involvement with stuff that's been going on, there's not been a problem in getting things done. Like I said, it's the enthusiasm of companies to actually issue paper at valuations which they consider too low. That's the real stumbling point.
Natalie, I know Land Trust have been quite active in lobbying for some of these reforms, so perhaps you can give us your perspective.
Yeah, I think that there's often been good ideas at the beginning, or the talk around a lot of the reforms have been to support UK equities, but then it quite quickly becomes about private rather than public equity. And we think that's been a bit of a missed opportunity, but we've been trying to engage, and I know Simon has as well, and others in the market, to try to get more support for public markets, because that's really important. Where are the private assets going to ultimately end up? It's been quite frustrating. But I think, you know, with what we heard yesterday from Rachel Reeves at the JP Morgan event, talking about stamp duty relief on IPO and other potential fiscal incentives for new IPOs, I think they are at least seeing that something isn't working correctly in the market. And I think the Mansion House Accords, for example, do provide an opportunity for AIM companies, but we also have to be quite proactive in trying to sell solutions to those signatories and encourage them to use the AIM unlisted element in order to attract flows into AIM as well.
Thomas, anything to add from Aberdeen's perspective?
At the moment, there's one that's publicly known at the moment, which is Shawbrook, and I was astounded by the speed at which they're aiming to become listed. I mean, this accelerated process. I'm not sure how they can be that confident that it all gets done by that point, but I believe they're talking about 10 days or thereabouts, 2 weeks. So, you know, the level of education, investor education, that needs to be done in a very short space of time, followed by management meetings, and then pulling all that together into a book. I mean, I believe that's the sort of improvement in the speed of execution that could make the UK a more attractive place to do business.
Yeah, it's a really tight time frame. And Ray, so where are you seeing the strongest investor interest, with the UK being so deeply undervalued?
There is growing interest in the States.
Yeah.
And there, it's patchy. Okay, I mean, one of the problems, the definition in the US of what large cap is and mid cap is and small cap is very different to our own views about these things. Mid cap will go quite a long way up the FTSE 100 for a US investor. And that's something of a challenge still. So as you get further down, then there's an awful lot of really, no, we're not interested in that kind of stuff. But there is growing interest from the States for sure. And the European side of it, I'm sure you'll all be aware of at least one broker who will tell you the path to glory is by going all around Europe. It's how they always position themselves. Frankly, even back in the day when I was at CAS with Paul, we'd go to all these different European cities. It was great fun. It was lovely to go marketing in all these places. You never really saw any business out of it. And if you look at how the UK looks, and this is long before Brexit, I should say. So it's not a Brexit thing that means the Europeans aren't terribly interested in the UK market. So I think the European part is still a siren voice. It's the US. The US will make the difference.
We do need to get more domestic interest back into our market as well. And I think that selling pressure that we've seen for the last few years, but it's been a trend over the last 20, we need to, at least a levelling out in that would be very supportive for UK equities. And I think that there's work to be done on that side in terms of maybe government intervention, but also, I guess, structurally, things are turning more to the UK market advantage in terms of flows going into DC now and less so into DB, which have obviously been selling heavily in that period. So I think structurally, hopefully, we are going to be reaching that point of rotation.
And I think to add into that, I mean, the end of US exceptionalism is something we've all been hoping for and talking about, you know, as I've been trying to point out for as long as I can. Magnificent Seven is great as a title, but watch the movie and four die. Yes. Another one becomes a farmer. You know, there's only two right up into the sunset. This concentration risk is real, and I think is now being recognised much more widely.
I think the other thing, when you've lived through different eras, and I think that you were a fund manager, weren't you, Ray, in the 90s, if I may be so bold. OK, so I only caught the end of that decade, but back then, in the late 90s, your core customer base was segregated clients, defined benefit schemes, and then I moved up to Edinburgh and we had lots of life insurance money. That was great. And we won some seg business. I remember being thrown out as the young guy. They didn't really have any capacity for new business. We literally were turning business away. So they were sending out youngsters like me to learn on the job of how to market to an institutional client. And I can say that my hit rate was not as good as it would have been 10 years later. But it didn't really matter at that point because we just couldn't run any more money. Now we move forward 15 or 20 years later, and actually here we are. And actually, we're all, you know, every time there's a pitch now, it's big news because there aren't that many new pitches in institutional world. It's all about retail and wholesale. And retail and wholesale have learned that actually they can save some money by doing everything quite cheaply through passives. So if you look at the journey from those heady days in the 90s when actually, you know, there wasn't much question on what revenue margin you would earn. It was a given, you know, that you would have, you know, 75 plus, I think, in some cases, more good than 75. Pre-RDR, it was 150, and you might then, you know, have a nice trip with the client somewhere. And, of course, that was the way it worked back then. It was a trail commission basis. So that changed in 2014. So, look, the environment's changed massively, and therefore your shareholder lists will have changed because we aren't running as much money now as we did 15 or 20 years ago for segregated clients, and life insurance clients have also moved around and changed where they allocate their capital. So therefore, the money for the people for whom we're investing in your companies have changed dramatically. Our shareholdings will have therefore changed quite dramatically as well. And therefore, you need to look at which institutions are the beneficiaries of those big picture themes and which aren't.
No, I think that's a really good point for the IR audience, actually, is actually understanding the fund flows and where they're going as part of your targeting work. And just drawing back to Ray's comments, we're definitely seeing more international interest across our clients. Our larger caps and mid caps are seeing US investor interest. Europe, I agree with Ray, is always talked about by brokers. It's been a more challenging area to attract interest. But for our largest cap companies, we're seeing some demand from Asia, actually in Australia as well, and seeing more large cap IRAs actually visiting those locations for roadshows, which isn't something I've seen in a long time in my IR career. So definitely working harder and more globally to attract capital. Let's come on to talk about investor expectations and how to manage those. So perhaps, Natalie, first, can you share an event, a dinner, a site visit, a presentation that's really stood out to you? And I'm interested as to why. Bearing in mind, this is a really experienced IR audience. These are best-in-class IR programmes we're talking to here. So kind of what would differentiate a company's interaction with you as investors?
I think the thing that makes us excited from a meeting is a management team that sort of talk in our language. So I've outlined what we're looking for through our investment process. And I think the excitement we feel when we meet with a management team who think about their business in the same way as we're trying to look at that business is really what we're looking for. And there's a great deal of excitement that comes through finding a company, met with an engineering business recently, and just the great depth of IP in their business, for example, is something that was articulated so well that was something that made us all very excited. And when we talk about kind of cash flow return on capital, which is what we're looking at as a kind of test of an enduring competitive advantage, and some companies you meet with, that's how they're remunerated. That's how they think about the returns within their own portfolio. So I think it's that we're trying to glean through meetings, and there's different degrees to which management teams are able to, on the hoof, transition to talking about their business maybe in a slightly different way. And there's a balance because you want it to be true to the company that you're speaking to, but that ability to talk to what we're looking for rather than the slides or it is a big plus.
And Thomas, the same question to you.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some really, really positive, rich encounters. I mean, when I say rich encounters, sometimes it reminds you, we all got used to virtual conference calls and so on during COVID. And that became, I know for some of you who run very large companies, it's a necessity to use that. But I might be old fashioned, but I find in-person meetings infinitely richer because it's a human to human being contact. It's something about that, where you're actually in person, where actually you make that real connection. And I'm sure you've seen on VCs, people come and go and they're on camera and they're off camera. And are they really concentrating on every word you're saying? There's something about sitting in a room with somebody where you've caught their attention. And I think where that became the most alive for me was I've sat in a couple of investor dinners of actually smaller companies recently. And again, this isn't something that larger companies can necessarily replicate. But I went to one just last week, actually, and it was an incredibly positive experience because the new CEO of this asset management firm suddenly sort of just was genuinely interested in hearing how fund managers think, what we're looking for. And the evening continued. And actually what was good about it was that there was no sort of looking at the watch and saying, right, okay, 8 o'clock, we need to go now. We've got other things. It was actually incredibly relaxed. That sense of a two-way dialogue is so positive. And you may think to yourself, what do these fund managers know? They change their tune every 5 minutes. But it still might be worth listening to what people on the buy side think. And that sort of environment, which is quite an informal environment, can be a very positive way to do that.
That's really good advice. And Ray, you've talked about there being three numbers that companies should be communicating and thinking about. So simplification of results messaging and announcements. Could you maybe elaborate on what you've said previously?
Kind of sad, it's the TikTok generation, isn't it? Obviously, you spend hours preparing all these financial statements, probably not realising that what happens is at 7 o'clock in the morning, it hits an RNS, and I take a look at the front page and my trader shouts over straight away, what are they? It's like, right, well, I've got another 40 pages to go yet. I'll be back to you in a couple of hours' time. No one's got time for that. I've got various companies, right up to FTSE 10 companies. They've got 45 KPIs on the front page with three different levels of adjustments and constant currencies and actual currencies. And you're just looking at them going, I've no idea whether this has been good or bad. The three numbers thing. Each of your companies will be wildly different, but you'll all know that there's three numbers that people actually care about, whether they're in the right place or not. And you'll know whether they are or they aren't. And you can try and hide them, but we'll find them. So it's much better just get them up front. People want to know, are they okay? And what does the outlook statement say? Get that bit on the front page. The rest of the detail people can spend hours over. But I mean, I see colleagues who can spend 2 days working out how the fourth largest division's operating margin was 10 basis points different from what they thought. But who cares by that point? Really, I want to know what's going to happen to forecasts on the day. I want to know whether it's good enough that there's an upgrade or whether it's bad enough there's a downgrade, because that's what the market care about. The most value I can offer to fund managers, especially through a busy results season, is being able to just stick up on Bloomberg chat or ring them and say, these ones are fine, and I know you've got 15 other sets of results, and at least one of those is a problem. If I can do that quickly, because your statements help me to do that, then they benefit, and then everyone's happier, and the detail can come through later.
I would echo that and say oftentimes, you know, there's a balance sheet issue at a company, for example. Don't hide it on like page 20 because everyone's just going to scroll to that. But just having that up front, where people want to, is the first thing people think about when that company drops into the inbox. So, just fronting up potential issues early on in statements.
And as we start to think about the future of capital markets and how quickly things are evolving, I'm interested to ask the panel about AI and emerging technology. I've been interested in what, if anything, you're seeing around artificial intelligence and how it might currently shape your role and how it might shape your role in the future. So perhaps, Natalie, if you start by talking about that.
I think it's having a very big impact on our role day to day in terms of discussing AI and its impact. And obviously it is evolving and changing, but we've already seen the kind of sentiment hit that can come for certain companies and sectors where there is a kind of AI threat or risk associated to it. Our investment process brings us to quite a lot of software companies. So that naturally is something that we're having a lot of conversations with them about and just trying to learn as much as we can through reading, podcasts, etc., to support those conversations. Because I think once the AI question is raised about a company, it's incredibly hard to disprove it. And so we try to look across our portfolio and think about that impact. And then in terms of our own workflow, just exploring what's out there. And I think by using it, you better understand it and you better understand the pace of change of the underlying technology, which I think you can see in the last kind of 6 months, and that's really helpful. So while it's not a large part of our inbuilt workflows, we are increasingly using it to augment what we're doing in order to also understand it better.
We've seen some of the products that I think are being sold to the buy side, being sold into investor relations as well. And they tend to be, because there's a natural reticence of IR teams to upload any non-public data. Mm-hmm. So AI tends to focus on the market data. And I think the same products are being sold into the buy side and the sell side, which scrutinises companies' results in a potentially more efficient way. Thomas, you kind of touched on the challenge potentially being actually, where does the budget for these AI products tool? They might make your role more efficient, but is that something realistic for you to be considering taking on board?
I'm quite sceptical, but I'm not sure whether that's an age thing or not. But I'm
sceptical too.
The reason is that actually what's interesting is since AI really took off, we've seen a dramatic derating in companies that were supposedly bulletproof. So the likes of RELX, which was everybody's favourite quality stock. Now, it's a great business. There's no getting away from the barriers to entry are real there, and it's a great company. But it was trading on an awfully high rating. And if you look at LSE recently, again, it's a well-held stock. There are lots of people who own the likes of LSE. And so what's happening is that AI is proving to be a threat to companies on high valuations, because who knows how this is going to play out? Could it break down barriers and suddenly those moats become less powerful than people thought? And so I tend to think, well, I met Galliford Try recently, and it's a lovely little company. And in fact, you know, it's one that you know, isn't it, Clara? And the lovely thing is I said, so tell us about AI. And he said, well, it doesn't really apply to the construction industry. We've got a couple of cameras in a water treatment works. And you think, okay, that's the kind of AI I like. So it's not going to disrupt Galliford Try in what they do. It's bulletproof from, and by the way, that stock's trading on quite a low valuation. So you know, actually, will it adversely impact Imperial Brands in their core business? I don't think so. I think it will probably be a net benefit. So I tend to, by coming at it from a different angle and slightly more sceptical, actually, I think that as fund managers, we've got to learn that technology can be very powerful for us if we embrace it and harness it. And we're doing that in our day-to-day work. But it can also disrupt industries. And we've got to be very careful what we pay for those industries.
I would just give an example from BP's recent results, because I think there was a stat in that that was that really struck me, that was that they would work with Palantir and they were going to be reducing their ERP spend by 85%. And I think that really shows the impact. Obviously, it has an impact on BP in terms of their cost savings that they're able to drive. But all of those different software companies that they're currently using, that's a huge impact on them. So, yeah, just to give a slight counter.
And before we open up to audience Q&A, because I want to allow plenty of time for your questions, just as we think and we look ahead, I guess, Ray, what gives you optimism as we look ahead?
The market's cheap. Yeah. That, to me, is the absolute key. The market's cheap. There are so many cheap companies out there. 7 o'clock, you're flooded by the number of share buybacks. You know, mm-hmm. Pretty obvious how cheap the market is. And I think that's the absolute key.
And Natalie, are you seeing much, obviously some great IPOs in the press? We've got Beauty Tech and Fermi last week, Shawbrook coming as well. Are you seeing an uptick now in pre-deal investor marketing for IPOs?
Yes, definitely. I think I saw one yesterday, Early Look. We've got two in the next 2 weeks. We are, I'd say in the last month we've seen four or five. So there's definitely an uptick in Early Look activities. And when that translates and when those companies have come to market and choose to come to market, it's obviously unknown. But I think everything we're seeing and hearing is indicating a return to activity. So that's very positive.
And Thomas, what are you optimistic about?
Yeah, I'm going to nuance my optimism slightly, which is that we've got to get through the 26th of November. Yeah. And the black hole is quite a lot bigger than it was a year ago. And I'm afraid part of the reason why that black hole's got bigger is the actions that were taken last October. And Tesco and the like have been very brutally honest about the impact of policies like national insurance on employee on the employers, which has been very detrimental in terms of, you look at the immediate impact that's had on employment in the UK month by month, there's a very, very clear line, and that was last year's budget. So we need to hope and pray that actually the actions in November will not have that same doom loop risk, that because the more policies that are implemented that go against economic growth, that go against SME formation, that go against employment and actually a vibrant economy, the more difficult the UK is as a sell. And the US has, the US investors, as Ray said, have a way of understanding that the UK intrinsically is a great place to be. We all live here, I presume. Most of us will live here. It's a great place. It's a great culture. It's a great way of life. But it's fragile, and let's hope that it's not destroyed, because we are a long way at the moment from a Singapore on Thames ethos here. You know, remember after Brexit, there was a hope that this would become animal spirits. The UK would become the most vibrant place in Europe and potentially one of the most vibrant places in the world. We seem to be some way from that, but the ingredients are there. So let's hope that we can get through the 26th of November.
Great. So now I'd like to open up to audio Q&A. We've got a microphone that we'll pass around. And if you can just say your name and where you're from. I can see Simon's keen to ask one.
Hi there. Simon Ray from Iristana. And firstly, I'd just like to say thank you very much to all the panellists and Clara for really interesting comments today. The question I'd like to ask is, when you feel as investors we're going to see a sustained inflow of funds into the UK and that's going to change? I appreciate that's perhaps a slightly unfair question. So perhaps if I reframe it, if we assume at some stage there will be a inflection point in fund flows in the UK and at least sentiment in the UK, do you think at that point that the rising tide lifts all boats, or do you have any feelings about how the market will differentiate between different companies in terms of market cap or sector or value proposition?
Shall I start off? Because technically, as the fund management analyst, this is meat and drink. Next quarter, on a rolling basis. One of the big reasons why you've been seeing outflows as much as anything else has been reallocations of old-fashioned money, life company money, wealth management companies, reallocating based on indices. So you've seen most of the wealth managers go from having 15, 20% of their investments in UK equities down to 4. Pretty much everyone has gone there now. So we're at the tail end of that part still. There was a couple that happened earlier on this year. But that part of the reallocation down should now have largely washed through the system. So to the extent that in the end, all these things, the concentration is on net flows, but as we all know, that's the very small difference between a very big gross inflow and a very big gross out. To the extent that the gross outs start to abate, then that's when the turn comes in due course. Is it next quarter? Well, certainly as we're going to go through this reporting period, it's not now. But as we get through, I think, November and into next year, then there are more positive signs about it, I think. I am conscious of the boy crying wolf.
Natalie or Thomas?
I was going to say we were always very cautious to call when that might happen, because I think it's very hard to call, and all we can say is the conditions are there for that to happen that we've outlined. In terms of how that's felt in the market, I think so far we've been seeing passive flows into UK, and obviously that concentrates things at the larger end. I hope that then trickles down, but it depends what form those flows take. So if that trend continues, you'd continue to probably expect a large cap outperformance.
Yeah, that was exactly the point. I mean, the net inflows into UK equities are actually positive, believe it or not, but thanks to passives. If it wasn't for passives, it would be quite strongly negative. So therefore, you know, clearly there's a market cap influence that that has. And so passives tend to benefit FTSE 100 companies.
Hey guys, Jack Bradshaw from Equitory. Just on the allocation point, what do you think about kind of artificial measures? So I don't know, like minimum allocations of pension funds into domestic equities, for example. And then just on your point, Ray, about the shift of wealth management kind of from 15% to 4%, 4% is kind of more commensurate with the kind of UK's proportion internationally. So 15% is kind of a home bias level, right, that you kind of maybe don't necessarily want to get back to. But then, it's, you know, do you kind of envisage that you would like to see that level return?
I think getting back to 15 is probably a stretch, but there's nothing like a market going up to make people think about what they're missing out on. And you see that individually in stocks and sectors as well. And asset allocators are no different. If something starts happening and they're not on it, then you'll start to see allocations back to a rising market for fear of missing out. If we just go from 4 back to 5, frankly, that'll do. And that'll change the tone really quite a long way. So it's not as though we're expecting much. I don't think you have to go back to the old days because that was unbalanced. If you look at the domestic allocation by investors relative to domestic allocation, not of the US, because the US has gone through a particular stage, but look at Australia, look at the Europeans, they've all got a much greater home bias than we've now got. And in that respect, you know, we are the laggard, and therefore there's more scope to be made up. But you need an environment for it. Now, does that mean a bricer? Well, that will... There are some people, I'm looking randomly in the audience, some people would be quite against the idea of a bricer, and I think I am too. But equally, if we are going to offer a tax advantage to people to save, which I think, as a society, is the right and proper thing to do, then why can't we gear that towards a benefit for our own home market? You know, that's where PEP started. PEPs were before ISAs for the young ones. So when PEPs first started, it was a UK investment vehicle. Well, bring that back. That doesn't mean you can't buy NVIDIA. That doesn't mean you can't go and buy Apple if that's what you want to do. But why should we give you a tax break to do so? Yeah. And I think that would be a perfectly sensible move.
Yeah, I think we are such an outlier and we're scrambling around for growth. And our companies are incredibly cheap and unable to use their paper to grow and invest. So I think it's completely logical and I would argue moral to use fiscal incentives to get investment back into the UK, because I think turning that cycle, that doom loop around is beneficial for society at large. And if we want to continue to create wealth within the country, then the equity market has a role to play in that. And I think just giving out fiscal benefits is an unequal way of distributing that. And so I was quite hopeful when Labour came into power that they would look at that and address that, because I felt it was an obvious lever and something that was aligned with their wider ethos. But it is yet to happen.
Yeah, unfortunately, votes come from different policies and different magnitudes. And I have a feeling this is one of the less voter-friendly options. But it doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. And let's hope that sanity prevails. I mean, the cash ISAs, I think Wilson Review, Lord Wilson of Legal & General, that's not his full title, I should add. He used to work at Legal & General. But Lord Wilson came up with the idea, and he said the amount of money sitting in cash ISAs. And actually, although at one point it felt during a crisis, it feels very nice having some cash, doesn't it? Sort of think, oh, I'm glad I'm not owning these equities. They're awfully variable, aren't they? But over the lifetime, when you think about how much you forfeit by owning cash rather than equities, even UK equities, believe it, not just US equities or emerging market equities. You know, other asset classes also do better than cash. So actually it's in the interests of the population to be weaned off cash.
Right. And as we wrap up, I'm going to ask each of you the same question, which is, what is your one piece of advice you would like to give to companies seeking to attract capital today? So Ray, we'll start with you.
Make the story easy.
I was going to say clarity of message, but
and Thomas.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that relationship point is, if it's worth, it's worth picking up the phone, it's worth inviting fund managers who you can target as potential investors or current investors along to kick the tires a bit. If you can do a CMD, it's amazing the turnout actually in the regions for relatively obscure companies. I've turned up at CMDs in some fairly far-flung places, and actually it's amazing. It must be that sitting here in an office in the City of London doesn't have as much appeal as going out and actually meeting the management team and seeing. I remember once actually seeing they had the old version of Windows, and this company went on to profit warn because it had, and I remember thinking, and it was the Windows XP at the time, and I'm thinking, it was a giveaway. This company wasn't even keeping up with sort of updating the Microsoft account.
It's probably a bad example of how to encourage people to buy the shares.
Well, look, thank you all very much for sharing your time and your insights with our audience today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Enquire, the Investor Relations podcast. I'm your host, Clara Melia. For more IR insights, please do follow Equatory on LinkedIn and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss an episode. Plus, if you're interested in featuring on this podcast or have any feedback, please email us at info@equatory.com. Once again, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.